Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Deeper Waters podcast. My name is Nick Peters. We got a really good show lined up for you today. There's going to be a little bit of a delay, though, with my guest coming in. My guest is Dr. Mark Goodacre, and I'll be telling you more about when he comes in. But apparently, he had promised his daughters a little something special, and he has to deliver them back first. And family comes first, but he said he's going to be here in about 10 minutes or so. So, until then, you get to put up with me, so just decide how worthwhile you think that is. We've had an interesting morning already. My wife and I actually went to a Messianic congregation this morning, and the family already likes us. They let me borrow a few books, and had another one come in the mail today, so out of this book I'm reading now, I've got 5 waiting in line. Oh, yep, I am a busy guy. Yeah. And also, I'd like to remind everyone that we've got an event coming up soon, and that is, it's actually going on right now, and it is the Deeper Waters fundraiser, and it's done through Premier Jewelry, and you can get all the details with my friend Lena Klester, yeah, and just email her, and it's lena.klester, and I'm looking it up right now. What it is that with this email here, this event going on, Lena.Klester, LAYNA.CLESTER at Comcast.net, that she sells for Premier Jewelry, which is a Christian company. And for you guys that have Valentine's Day coming up here, well, which is all of us, but for you guys who have someone special that you want to be buying for this year, jewelry makes a really great gift a lot of times. The ladies really, really love it. I mean, my wife can't even wear a lot of jewelry because she's got an allergy to nickel, which makes it difficult, but if there's any kind of jewelry that she can wear that doesn't have nickel in it, she just adores getting the chance to wear it. So, your ladies will definitely want some jewelry on Valentine's Day. And you know what? If you buy through Premier with Lena Klester and you use the password of love, 25% of what you purchase will go to support us at Deeper Waters. Yeah, that's a whole 25%. That means if you spend $40 on Valentine's Day getting your sweetheart something special, $10 will go to our ministry. Now, how can you beat a deal like that? You get to give something to your lady, she shows you her appreciation, and at the same time, you get to give to a growing Christian ministry. That's something that's quite special to get to do. Now, know about something else that I've been doing lately. See, in a couple of weeks, we're going to be having Tom Gilson come on. He runs a Thinking Christian. And we're going to be talking about Peter Boghossian. If you don't know, Peter Boghossian has written a book called A Manual for Atheist. Yeah, I've read the book. It must have failed because I'm still very much a theist, if not, in fact, more so. And so myself and some friends of mine, we've been going to Peter Boghossian's Facebook page, actually, and talking with some of these people that he's training up called street epistemologists, ones that are supposed to go out there and deconvert you from your faith. And well, to say the street epistemologists, it's not going well for them. Now, why does this matter to you? Because this guy is also wanting to start a show called The Reason Whisperer, where he's going to have a television crew with him talking to people and getting to see deconversions done, talking with people out, trying to get them out of their faith. And if he's going to area churches, I've already made a request, oh, please come to my church. Please do. And now, Peter has said that those of us who are Christians are going to be angry about being happy. On the contrary, I am quite excited about this show. I am thinking, you know, this could be the shot in the arm the church needs. And I'm just hoping that there will be even more well-trained Christians out there who can't answer these guys. Because, friends, answering these people is really very simple. There are some people out there, I'm not going to deny, who can make good cases. But if you meet someone who's supporting the new atheist line of thinking, they're not one of them. And honestly, when I meet someone who recommends I read a book like, say, The God Delusion, I already know we've got a case that I don't really need to take too seriously. Because they're building it on a flimsy foundation. Dawkins is not a philosopher. He needs to stick with what his area is. But it's this hubris I see with atheism that seems to think that we don't need to study. We don't need to read the scholarship. We just all know these things are false. We know rational people don't think this way. We know miracles don't happen, etc., etc., etc. All these things we know. And there's no study, usually, that goes into this. There's no willingness to interact with the greatest biblical scholars or Christian philosophers or Christian historians, anything like that. And yeah, I think I need to expand because not all biblical scholars, contrary to what you're told, are Christians. In fact, I'd say about half of them, at least, aren't Christians. But the good is one who's reading our side. What I usually find when I encounter those on the atheistic side is they've read one side, if that much, and that's their own. If you want to hear them talk about the Bible, well, here comes Bart Ehrman out here, or Dan Barker, or John Loftus, or if you want to talk about the history, well, it's Richard Carrier. I mean, yeah, he holds the Christ myth. Yes, that's a total joke in our scholarly fields out there that study the Bible, study history. No one takes that seriously, but hey, who cares? Go ahead and put all our eggs in the Carrier basket because, you know, he disagrees with Christianity. And that is all we need. Well, that's one reason also we have this show. So you can be equipped with a Christian scholarship for when you meet these guys. Now, I encourage you to be reading the atheistic scholarship. You're in. Okay, I've just received word Dr. Goodacre is about to call in here. But be listening to what we have to say here and check my guests out. Check their works. Check their books. Anything you can here. Now, we are still waiting here for Dr. Goodacre to call. That's why I'm hesitant to really start talking about anything else at this point, since he's going to be here soon. And we're very fortunate because we thought we might be able to only get in an hour with him, so we'll get to have our time. We're going to be talking today about the Gospel of Thomas, and I'm hoping today we can talk about Q some as well, since we're beginning into discussion about the synoptics. Now, some of you could be listening and saying, what is he talking about at this point? Well, I'd go into it, but I think it's best to let my guest handle that whenever he calls in. But Mark Goodacre is an excellent scholar in this field, excellent mind, and well, that could be him right now, so let me see here. Dr. Goodacre, is that you?
Hello, yeah, that's me. Hi, how you doing?
Hello, I hope things have gone well for you and you went out.
Just back from taking out the family for a quick lunch, but dash back so that I can get here on the show with you.
Okay, are you going to be able to stay here till 5?
Yeah, that sounds great. Looking forward to it.
Okay, well, let me tell the audience, since I haven't got to tell them about you, so I figured if I'm making mistakes, now you can correct me, but you studied at the Exeter College in Oxford in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
You got a bachelor's in theology.
In fact, it's celebrating, Exeter College is celebrating its 700th anniversary this year. It was founded in 1314.
Wow,
it's the fourth oldest of the... Yes, the fourth oldest of the Oxford University colleges.
Wow, it didn't look a day over 650. But you get a master's there also in New Testament and a PhD in New Testament. You've written a number of books such as The Case Against Q and your book on the Gospel of Thomas and how it depends on the synoptics. And right now you're the professor of New Testament and Christian Origins at Duke University in North Carolina. You run the NT pod, and let me tell you guys, the New Testament podcast that Dr. Goodacre runs, it's a great podcast because I find I like to listen to it if I'm making a short drive. Maybe I've got about 10 or 15 minutes. Well, why not pop it in and listen to what Dr. Goodacre has to say about the New Testament? And yeah, I'll go on and say it comes with a great advantage that everything he says sounds automatically much more intelligent since he says it with that wonderful British accent.
And we all talk like that in Britain, though.
And you run the NT Web blog. That's NTWEBLOG. So, Dr. Goodacre, I think I've got everything right there so far. So let's hear a little bit from you.
That's perfect.
Since you're in this field, how did you get to where you are today? Give us, in a nutshell, a Dr. Mark Goodacre story.
Well, it's nice of you to ask, and thanks again for inviting me onto your podcast. I suppose I, like a lot of academics, and you know, some people will be able to relate to this, not just with their academic careers, but other careers as well. I more fell into it than went into it by design. The basic thing for me was that I was going to be a minister in the Church of England. A lot of my family are ministers. My grandfather, lots of my uncles, and so on. So that was the path I was following. And that's, in order to do that, I decided to do a degree in theology. And I went to Oxford to do my degree in theology. And while I was doing that, I suppose it was a dual thing. One thing was that I fell in love with the study of theology and religion, and especially the New Testament. And at the same time as falling in love with the study of it, I began to realize that I was not called into the ministry, and that that wasn't the path that I should have been following. And then, you know, people said to me, hey, have you thought about doing research? Have you thought about doing a master's? Have you thought about doing a doctorate? And so I just kind of fell into it, really. I didn't leave, you know. I just enjoyed studying so much. And I'm just one of those very blessed people for whom study has basically been pretty much my living since I left school. So that's really what happened with me. I totally became entranced with the study of the New Testament, with Christian origins, and also a lot of the context and trappings that go around that. You know, I'm very interested in Second Temple Judaism. I'm also interested in early Christian texts going into the second and third centuries as well. So in a nutshell, that's really where it happened for me. It was never by design. It was simply something that happened because I just loved it and I stuck with it. And I realized that, it is a privilege having a job where you spend your days teaching and researching the New Testament, and it's not something that I take lightly because it's something that I know many, many people would love to be, spending their lives doing.
It's odd when you were listening, you say, Matt Kurz, our stories are kind of similar in that way. I went off to Bible college also, studying for a pastorate. And I've never been a pastor anyway. I mean, I am ordained now, but I'm not a preacher, because when I got there, I found out about apologetics, and I fell in love with apologetics. And
I see.
And for me, when I was reading in the school, and I'd be assigned all these books, I'd say, it's so hard getting all these books I'm assigned because they're keeping them away from all these other books that I'm already wanting to read. And just so many times, go to bed at 9, just tell my wife, say, I love what I do. Just the whole fear, it's such a joy.
Yes, yes.
So,
and
now,
in fact, I mean, I don't know about you, but I mean, I find that there are many people who say to me quite reasonably, gosh, I'd love to have your life, I'm fully conscious that having a life, like that, where you do get to devote yourself to study, although it's not for everybody, I think there are many people that would simply love to do that. So I not a day goes by when I don't feel myself, hugely privileged, to do what I do.
It is indeed a blessing. Think about the old hymn, there's joy in serving Jesus. Now, let's get a little bit to the show. We're almost to our first break, so we'll just introduce the topic a little bit here. Now, we're first starting with the Gospel of Thomas, and I could have some confused listeners out there now who might be saying, I don't see that book in my Bible anywhere. What is this Gospel of Thomas that you're talking about?
Well, in some respects, one of the most interesting things about it is that it isn't in the Bible. So, it automatically has a certain mystery and a certain enigma, a certain frisson, because you hear about this and you say, hey, what is this and where does it come from? And in fact, its history is pretty interesting. It was talked about a lot. At least from the late 2nd century and onward. I mean, so we know that the ancient Christian writers, the fathers and so on, they did talk about the Gospel of Thomas, so we know that they knew it. But it was lost for centuries because, basically what happens with these things is people just stop copying them after a while. And that was the fate of the Gospel of Thomas. And if people stop copying them, the text stops circulating, basically it goes to ground and gets lost. And so the text was completely lost for centuries until the 1890s. A fragment of it was dug up in Oxyrhynchus in Egypt by Grenfell and Hunt, two Oxford men. And they dug up a couple more fragments of it in the early 1900s. But even then, they were only fragments, Greek fragments. And our first complete text, or almost complete text, of the Gospel of Thomas didn't emerge until 1945, when it was discovered in Nag Hammadi in Egypt as part of a huge cache of texts, most of which are usually described as Gnostic.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a quick break. With that, since we're coming up on our first break, my guest is Dr. Mark Goodacre from Duke University in North Carolina. We're talking about the Synoptic Gospels, their relation to Thomas, and hopefully we can get into Q a little bit later on as well. I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back after this break.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
I can't believe in you today. Oh, I can't.
are back. I'm Nick Peters, the Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Dr. Mark Goodacre. We're talking about the relationship of Thomas to the Synoptics. Now, you were just telling us about how Thomas was found. Tell us a bit about what's in Thomas. If you open up the Gospel of Thomas, what do you find?
Well, the first thing that you see is that it's basically a bunch of Jesus' sayings, just one after another after another. So most of the little pieces of the Gospel of Thomas simply say, Jesus says, Jesus says, Jesus says, Jesus says. And that's really what it is. It's a collection of Jesus' sayings. Some of them are the little aphoristic sayings that you find in the Gospels of the New Testament, like foxes have their holes, the birds of the air have their nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. So you get some little aphoristic sayings like that. And then you get some parables. So the parable of the sower is in there, the parable of the lost sheep, the parable of the tenants in the vineyard, the parable of the rich fool. So you have material like that. But alongside all of those sayings that are pretty much familiar to us from the New Testament, we also have at least half of the sayings in the book are completely new. They're things that we have never seen before. And to some extent, that's the most interesting thing about the Gospel of Thomas, because you have Jesus sounding rather different from the Jesus that we know from the New Testament. And some of those sayings are quite strange. I mean, there's one which says, blessed is the man who consumes a lion, you know, and you suddenly you hear this stuff about, you know, lions and consuming lions and this, and then you have another really terse saying, just be passers by, and you think, what does that mean, you know? So and you have all sorts of interesting little sayings. You've got one or two new parables that we're not seeing in the New Testament. So that's really what's going on in the Gospel of Thomas. And it tends to be all the more interesting for the things that are not there. So if you're familiar, as probably I'm guessing most listeners are, at least to some degree, with the Gospels of the New Testament, all of them have a huge passion narrative, passion and resurrection story. They become like the major thing in the text. But the thing about the Gospel of Thomas, no passion narrative. In fact, no narratives of any kind. It doesn't have any birth stories. It doesn't have any of Jesus' miracle stories. It doesn't have anything like that, and absolutely no passion narrative, no resurrection story at all. So just this bunch of sayings. So it's a very different kind of piece of work from the Gospels that most people are familiar with from the New Testament.
So if you want to know about the life of Jesus, don't go to the Gospel of Thomas, right? Okay, well,
right.
Go ahead.
Sure, carry on.
No, go ahead.
If you only had the Gospel of Thomas and didn't have the Gospels of the New Testament, you wouldn't even know about things like Nazareth and Galilee, and you wouldn't know about, you know, all sorts of things that we find out about Jesus in the New Testament. I mean, no reference to Capernaum, nothing about calling the disciples, there's no transfiguration, there's no feeding of the 5,000. I mean, seriously, so many of the things that we pick up about Jesus from the Gospels are simply not there in the Gospel of Thomas. So it's a really, really strange piece of work. And in fact, I think most people, when they first come to it, they find it really jarring, they find it really unusual. And, you know, it's like, what is this that I'm looking at, is one of the first things people think.
And a lot of times I like to tell people who always talk about the Jesus and Paul in the New Testament being sexist. Like, hey, let's go to some of these other Gospels. I want to say, have you read the last saying yet in the Gospel of Thomas? It talks about, I will enable Mary to make herself male so she can enter the kingdom of heaven like you males.
Yes, it's quite remarkable, isn't it, that, yeah. And in fact, that, given that that's the very last thing that you see, it's like saying 114 of the Gospel of Thomas, it's like, what is that doing there?
Now, when I was in Bible college, I remember reading on my own the five Gospels, which is put out by the Jesus Seminar, so I'm sure you know where I'm going already, but tell my audience for me, what is this group called, the Jesus Seminar?
Well, the Jesus Seminar was formed in the 1980s, and one of the things that its founder, Robert Funk, who's now no longer with us, but one of the things that Robert Funk felt was that it was important for people to become more educated about the New Testament and to become more interested in the historical side of things. So he launched a whole group called the Jesus Seminar, and what they did is they got together and talked about what it was they thought Jesus was most likely to have said and done, and they began with Jesus' sayings. And their first major publication was a piece called The Five Gospels, the one you mentioned, and the five Gospels there are Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Thomas. And they kind of color-coded Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Thomas to illustrate where they felt the authentic Jesus sayings were and where the non-authentic sayings were. And I think one of the things that the Jesus Seminar did is that it therefore publicized the Gospel of Thomas to people who didn't know a lot about it before that, and raised the question, which I think is still key for lots of people, which is, you know, how much historical Jesus information is there in something like the Gospel of Thomas?
But to be fair, the Jesus Seminar didn't necessarily reflect mainstream scholarship, did it?
Well, I think you're right. I agree with that. But I think that their aim was to try and be a little bit more mainstream than they ended up being. Part of it was that it depended on who actually turned up to the meetings and who became part of it. But yes, I think that it's fair to say that the Jesus Seminar, although it contained a lot of very fine scholars, I mean, one person in particular, John Dominic Crossan, whatever you think of his views, and I actually disagree with him on on a great deal, but whatever you think about his views, he is a fine scholar and he's a stimulating scholar. So I wouldn't want to disparage the quality of the scholarship, but yes, I think you're right in saying that in the end they didn't represent consensus views, and they certainly didn't incorporate much in the way of anybody from more conservative or from more evangelical circles, definitely.
Yeah, I think I remember even Craig Evans in one of his books, Fabricating Jesus, said there wasn't anyone from, say, any of the European schools, for instance.
Yes, that's right, yeah. It's a very much, I think it's largely USA and Canada, and it tends not to be, I mean, my colleague here at Duke, Richard Hayes, who's now the Dean of the Divinity School at Duke, I mean, he wrote a piece that was critical of the Jesus Seminar, but one of the things that he pointed out is that it wasn't just that the seminar tended to have a particular kind of profile for the scholars, but also it didn't have anybody who was representative of a lot of the major universities, a lot of the major schools in the U.S. So, you know, there's no one from Duke or Yale or Princeton or Emory or where else can we throw in Brown, you know, I mean, and a lot of people that were involved with the Jesus Seminar thought that was a kind of an elitist thing to say, but I think the point Hayes was trying to make is that it wasn't as mainstream a project as lots of people like to, you know, make out that it was, you know.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned John Dominic Crossan, because I was going to bring him up as well. He's said that he dates the Gospel of Thomas to about 75 A.D.
Mm-hmm. Now, and sometimes, yeah, I mean, he's a little bit vague as well, because he'll sometimes even talk about an early version of the Gospel of Thomas being as early as the middle of the first century. So, you know, he thinks it's one of the earliest witnesses we have to historical Jesus tradition. So he thinks it's highly important.
But how many scholars have come along and said, yeah, we think we can date Thomas to that time period as well. We think we can date it to about 75 A.D.
I mean, I would say that that's a minority view. Yeah, it's a minority view. Because even some people that regard the Gospel of Thomas as having lots of material in it that's kind of original or early, they would still not date the document itself as early as the first century. I mean, you know, take someone like Stephen Patterson, who has written one of the best books on the Gospel of Thomas, but nevertheless disagrees. You know, I disagree with him, but you know, I still think his work is excellent. And one of the things that he says in his book is that he thinks that the Gospel of Thomas probably dates from the early 2nd century, but he feels that it features lots of independent Jesus traditional material in there.
When do you date the Gospel of Thomas?
I date it in about 140. I think that the best bet is that it's written well into the 2nd century. There are several reasons for thinking this. One of the clearest reasons is that I think that the Gospel itself shows knowledge of the New Testament Gospels, specifically Matthew and Luke. And I think for it to have such extensive knowledge of Matthew and Luke means that it's probably later rather than earlier. So I think that's one thing which, you know, one has to throw into the mix, you know, that obviously if Thomas knows Matthew and Luke, if he's got copies of Matthew and Luke, then clearly it predates Matthew and Luke. You know, it's getting the material it shares with them from them and not from the same shared oral traditions and so on. But that, of course, only takes us part of the way. I mean, Thomas wouldn't have to be terribly late if it knows Matthew and Luke. It could be much earlier. But I think one of the signs that it is a little later is that it has a saying in there. It's which seems to imply knowledge of not only the destruction of the temple, but also of the Bar Kokhba War, which took place in 135, or so was sort of completed in 135. And my hunch is that to make sense of the Gospel of Thomas as we have it, it has to be after the Bar Kokhba War. So I think it's written in about 140 or so. That's my guess. It can only ever be guesses with these things. It can't be as precise as that. But the broadest window of dating would be, I would say, from the early 2nd century to about, the latest it could possibly be written would be about the 170s, but I don't think it's quite that late. I think we're talking early to middle 2nd century. So it's pretty old, it's just not quite as old as the Gospels that we've got in the New Testament.
And I think another case that's been brought forward, and I think Nicholas Perrin did a lot of work on this one, and I hope I'm pronouncing that name right, is that he thinks the Gospel was originally written in Syriac, and he did this by translating the Gospel back into Syriac, and he noticed some interesting patterns.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, Nick and I are friends going back a while. In fact, we even co-edited a book together on Q a while ago. I don't quite agree with him on his dating of Thomas. I think his dating of Thomas is a little bit too late. I think to push it right into the late 2nd century, I think it's a little less plausible. For one thing, one of the strange things about the Gospel of Thomas is that it doesn't really refer to John at all. So although it's got all of these parallels to Matthew and Luke and one or two to Mark, it really doesn't have any really close verbatim parallels with John. And that makes me think that it's not quite as late as Nick wants to date it. I'm also not persuaded by Nick's very interesting case that the Gospel was composed in Syriac. My friend Simon Gathercole, who is at University of Cambridge in the UK, Simon has argued recently, in a book came out almost exactly the same time as mine, actually, called The Composition of the Gospel of Thomas. Simon argued that the Gospel of Thomas was actually composed in Greek and that it was not composed in Syriac or any other Semitic language. And I think his case is very strong. It's made over many pages. So I'm convinced that it is actually composed in Greek. I think that that's the correct judgment. Nevertheless, you know, what I would say about Nick Perrin's work as well is he's written two books on the Gospel of Thomas, and the second one, about the Gospel of Thomas, gives a very useful introduction to the Gospel of Thomas and surveys lots of the issues in Thomas scholarship really well.
You know, something some of my listeners might be wondering about also is why is it called the Gospel of Thomas. The Thomas Watfisk, right. Well, obviously, if it's mid-second century, unless he lived an extraordinary long life, he didn't. So why would it be called the Gospel of Thomas?
Well, what happens, I think, as you get into the second century, and you see this in not just here in the Gospel of Thomas, but in a whole range of second, third, fourth century Gospels, is the further away that people get from the source material, the further away you get from the first century, the more you get these authorial fictions where you have somebody composing a gospel and attributing it to one of Jesus' disciples. And what they're generally doing is they're trying to say, read this because this will give you the inside story, you know, the special, unique, enigmatic, mysterious, secret story that you haven't read about before. And it's a sort of legitimizing move. What they're trying to do is they're trying to make the gospel something really kind of special and authoritative by pinning it to a particular person. So, you know, in this period, you've also got the Gospel of Peter. You've got a book called the Protoevangelium of James, which is supposed to be written by Jesus's brother James. And in the Gospel of Thomas, the claim is it's right up front and center. I mean, right there at the beginning of the Gospel, it says, these are the secret sayings that the living Jesus spoke, and they were written down by Didymus, Judas, Thomas. And so you then say, right, who is this character? Well, the word Thomas in Aramaic means twin, and the word Didymus in Greek means twin. So what this is saying is that basically the book is written by the twin Judas Thomas, or the twin Judas, or Judas the twin, some combination of things like that. And the claim seems to be that this person, the twin, is closer to Jesus than anybody else, and therefore has a unique opportunity to witness to the historical Jesus and to say something special about the historical Jesus, about the Jesus of, you know, the first century. So that's really what's going on. And it's, of course, it's fictional. I mean, nobody seriously thinks that Judas Thomas was actually writing this piece. It's a fiction that's created by somebody to lend these sayings a special kind of authority.
Now, you said the early church knew about the Gospel of Thomas. We didn't know about it for quite a while, and I mean, we knew that they knew about it, but we didn't know what it said entirely. What did the early church think about the Gospel of Thomas?
Well, it's an interesting one. I mean, the Church Father Origen in the 3rd century seems to be pretty negative about the Gospel of Thomas. I mean, he thinks, Origen does, that the Gospel is written by a heretic, and that it's what we're not getting, you know, pure Jesus tradition there. And that seems to be a fairly standard view amongst early church fathers. I mean, Hippolytus also very negative about the Gospel of Thomas, and says that it's used by a group of Gnostics called the Narcenes, and he's very negative about it as well. So that's the basic gist of the way that those characters responded to the Gospel of Thomas. Now, of course, there must have been people at the same time that rather liked the Gospel of Thomas, otherwise they wouldn't have been copying it, and it wouldn't have been the case that the church fathers were so interested in it. I mean, if nobody was talking about it, then they wouldn't have been going to such lengths to tell everybody that it was heretical. And it does seem to have been reasonably popular. I mean, in Oxyrhynchus in Egypt, as I mentioned not long ago, I mean, they found three Greek fragments that date from as early as the late 2nd century up into the middle of the 3rd century. And that does suggest that the text was pretty popular. And these three fragments are fragments from three different copies. They're written by different hands on different kinds of papyrus. So these are different copies of the text. So clearly there are some people that really like this text. But who these people are is difficult to know because, of course, we have many more works of the Orthodox Christians that survive than we have of the works like the Gospel of Thomas, which were regarded by the Orthodox with suspicion. So it's a fascinating world to dip into because it's a world where you've got a lot of disagreement about which texts are authoritative and which ones aren't, you know.
Well, we're going to take a quick break at this point. I'm Nick Peters of Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Dr. Mark Goodacre of Duke University, the professor of New Testament and Christian Origins. We'll be back after this break.
It's here, the official Grok Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite Grok Radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphone, and tablet. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, cyiworldwide.com. Grok Radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
And we're here back with Dr. Mark Goodacre. And I'd like to remind you, if you want to call in and ask a question about the Gospel of Thomas, our call-in number is 714-242-5180. Now, the Jesus Seminar did include Thomas in their canon, as it were. Mm-hmm. So what do you think? Has the church made a mistake with the canon? Should we have included Thomas in it?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's a great question, and if I may, I'll answer it in a couple of different ways. First thing to say is that I think we have to be careful when we're doing historical work not to make decisions about history, not to make decisions about our academic study on the basis of what is in the canon and what's outside of it. So in other words, I'm completely open to the possibility that somebody could discover some ancient document that's not, you know, from the canon, which could contain good historical Jesus information. It's just that in my view, the Gospel of Thomas isn't that book. So I do want to make that point that I think as historians, it's very important that we take all source material seriously and we avoid a kind of canonical bias whereby we say, well, you know, I'm not even going to bother studying that because it's not in the canon, because I think that would be wrong as a perspective on history. But I suppose the other way that I want to answer it is, I don't think the church made a mistake in not including it, because the Jesus that it describes, the Jesus that it bears witness to, isn't the Jesus that the church decided to canonize, if this is making sense. In other words, what happens is the Gospel of Thomas is witnessing to a different kind of Jesus. For example, it's pretty clear from the pages of the New Testament that the Jesus that becomes the center as time goes on of the church's creeds and of the way that the church preaches the gospel, that Jesus is somebody whose identity is at least partly bound up with being Christ, Son of God, who dies for people's sins on the cross and is raised from the dead on the third day according to the scriptures. Now, of all of those things that are key to most documents in the New Testament and to many of the early church writers, the Gospel of Thomas doesn't really share a lot of those. For example, it's not interested in Jesus as the Christ. There is no point where the Gospel of Thomas describes Jesus as the Christ, the Messiah, the Anointed One. It doesn't describe Jesus as the Son of God. So you can already see there, if you know anything about Christianity, I mean, that's Christianity 101, isn't it? Jesus is the Christ. And the Gospel of Thomas doesn't really seem to celebrate Jesus as the Christ, you know. So I think you can put that there right on the table as number one. But I mean, throw in there as well, Passion and Resurrection, which we've already mentioned. The Gospel of Thomas doesn't appear to think that the most significant thing about Jesus is the death and the resurrection. And what's more, it's not just the death and resurrection. If you think of Paul's earliest confession about Jesus in 1 Corinthians 15, he talks about Christ dying for our sins according to the scriptures and Christ being raised on the third day according to the scriptures. Now, Thomas doesn't like terms like according to the scriptures. You will not find anywhere in the Gospel of Thomas the author saying according to the scriptures. In fact, it seems to have a fairly negative view to the Hebrew Bible, to the Old Testament. It seems to think that this is, I mean, there's one moment in the Gospel of Thomas where the disciples come to Jesus and they say, look, 24 prophets prophesied over you. And Jesus replies and says, you're talking about dead people when the living one is in your midst. And that's one of the curious things about the Gospel of Thomas, that it seems to think that the prophets, far from being people that foretell Jesus and Jesus' death and resurrection, he doesn't even really want to acknowledge that they're anything important at all. So Thomas has this fairly negative view about the Hebrew Bible, and a negative view, as far as we can tell, about lots of these other things that emerging Christianity regarded as central.
Now, there are some people who think the Gospel of Thomas also has some Gnosticism in it. What do you think about that?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that is very difficult about the Gospel of Thomas is that there are certain things in there that sound rather Gnostic. I mean, right early on in Gospel of Thomas 3, the third thing, he already is talking about the importance of knowledge, and the term gnosis is simply the Greek word for knowledge. And so one way of defining Gnostics is to say, well, are these people who exalted knowledge at all? And does Thomas share this exaltation of knowledge? Now, a lot of Gnostics would have thought of knowledge as being more important than faith, as opposed to a lot of other early Christians that thought faith in Jesus was the key thing. And if you look at the Gospel of Thomas, generally it seems to be more interested in gnosis, in knowledge, than it is in faith. So in that respect, it does resemble other early Gnostic texts. But if you're picking up a little bit of caution in my voice in accepting that Thomas is Gnostic, that's because Thomas doesn't look like most full-on Gnostic texts. For example, it doesn't really have the big kind of Gnostic cosmology that you see in a fully-fledged Gnostic text like the Apocryphon of John. For example, it doesn't really even talk about the great creator figure. It doesn't talk about the demiurge. It doesn't talk about any of the kind of big cosmic sort of speculations that drove lots of Gnostic texts. So it's a really curious one to pigeonhole, and that's one of the reasons I think people are so fascinated with Thomas, because it looks a little bit Gnostic in some respects, but then it really doesn't have that full-on, really kind of carefully worked-out Gnostic cosmology going on. So I don't think I would call it a Gnostic text myself, though I would say that it's a text that clearly a lot of Gnostics rather liked, if that makes sense. It's a text that some people liked. And I mentioned earlier on that our only complete copy of the Gospel of Thomas was found in 1945 and is available in Coptic. I mentioned that is our only complete text. And the thing about that is that does appear in a codex alongside other very clearly Gnostic texts. For example, the very next text in Codex 2 where it appears is the Gospel of Philip. And the Gospel of Philip is clearly and explicitly Gnostic. It's what's known as a kind of Valentinian Gnostic text. So Thomas is fascinating in that respect. It's almost like a halfway house between the Synoptic Gospels, the Gospels of the New Testament, and the Gnostic texts like the Gospel of Philip or like the Apocryphon of John.
And just to be sure, we should be clear what we're talking about. For the listeners who might not know, what exactly are we talking about when we say Gnostic? Over and over.
Well, it's a tough one. I mean, the term Gnostic essentially means means people who are interested in knowledge. The Greek word for knowledge is gnosis, and gnostikoi in Greek are like knowledge ones. It'd be as if these days we were talking about, you know, the knowledge people really interested in knowledge. And that at its most basic level is what a Gnostic is. It's someone who stresses knowledge about mysteries that help them to commune with the inner self, or with the, or with getting to grips with how the universe really is. And the reason why this is a complicated question, which, and I'm afraid it's one of those frustrating things about Gnosticism that, you know, one can't do a really straight answer, but the reason why it's complicated is that you do have Gnostic texts, like the Apocryphon of John, which talk about a fully-fledged different cosmology from the kind of cosmology you have in the New Testament. And for many texts like that, the God who created this world isn't God of the Old Testament who, you know, spoke through the prophets and so on. It's a kind of a less, there's a creator God who is a lesser figure. And there are these wonderful sort of emanations, there are all sorts of kind of spiritual figures that abound. I mean, so you read this amazing sort of speculation about all these different spiritual figures. So it's different from Orthodox Christianity, but it has elements within it that are drawn from Orthodox Christianity, if that makes sense. And of course, what a lot of people point out is that when Gnosticism is really beginning to develop and to emerge in the second and third centuries, this is really before you have a fully worked out, clear kind of idea of what Orthodox Christianity is in any case. So this, so it, in a way, it's kind of battling for attention with lots of other Christians. And there may have been some people who were kind of a bit mixed, you know, who took in a little bit of Gnosticism on the side of their Christianity. We, you know, it's a really interesting topic digging down into this. But there are, there are figures early. Sorry, carry on.
I was saying, when you talk, I mean, it'd be a little bit like people who do what we call folk Christianity today, where they have Christianity, then they have some of the things they've carried over from other religions.
That's right. Yeah. And I think that's one of the reasons that a lot of Orthodox Christians had problems with Gnostic Christians, because they felt that it was, what should we say, they felt that the Gnostics were not maintaining true to what they saw as the real vision of a Christianity that is in continuity with the Hebrew Scriptures.
Now, I'd like to go back to something you said at the beginning of all that. You talk about the Gnostics placing the strong emphasis on knowledge, and I can already picture a critic saying, well, here on this show, you try and bring in the best scholars that you can, who are men of knowledge and such, so here you're talking about the active pursuit of knowledge about Jesus. How is that any different from what the Gnostics were doing?
Right. And, you know, I mean, there would have been overlaps between the way that they were doing things. I mean, what's kind of fascinating about one of the early heresiologists, one of the people that made his career on opposing what he saw as heresy, the early church father Irenaeus. Now, Irenaeus is end of the 2nd century, early 3rd century. Irenaeus, when he writes his big treatise against the Gnostics, talks about writing against those who talk about knowledge, and then he says falsely so-called. In other words, he doesn't like the idea that the Gnostics are praising their attempts to get hold of knowledge, because as far as Irenaeus is concerned, true knowledge comes through the knowledge of Jesus Christ, a Son of God who's fulfilled in the Scriptures. So he is, he says, you know, of course knowledge is good, but we want the right kind of knowledge, right? So you know, you have that, that battle going on for what is the true knowledge, and the Gnostics have one view on that, and the Orthodox, like Irenaeus, have another view on that.
I remember reading an atheist, which I don't remember who it was, but I used to think it was Clement of Alexandria, said that a Christian was a Gnostic. And so I went and I looked this text up immediately in Clement's writings, and what it is that Clement is in fact making fun of the Gnostics. When I gather, and you say, you think you have knowledge. No, Christians are the true Gnostics, because they're the ones who truly have the knowledge of who God is, and the Gnostic movement doesn't have that knowledge.
That's right, exactly. That's very much how they saw things. They regarded these Gnostics as abusing the term knowledge. They didn't like the way that, as far as they'd seen it, they were, you know, taking over the term and using it, you know, for their own purposes.
Now, the Gnostics also prized secret knowledge, that you had to be a part of a group and devote yourself to a group. It'd be kind of, for some of my listeners could relate, it's kind of like what the Mormons have with what goes on in the temple stays in the temple, and you keep it that way so outsiders won't get the knowledge.
Yes, I've used that analogy myself before, because I think there's another parallel with groups like the Latter-day Saints, which is that quite often, if you look at some of the Latter-day Saints materials, a lot of them look fairly orthodox, in inverted commas, on the outside, but it's only when you get into the kind of the deeper teachings, the you know, the ones for, you know, those, you know, a bit more behind closed doors, as it were, that one gets to or self-consciously different from Orthodox Christianity. Now, that might be unfair, because I'm not an expert at all on Mormonism, have to make clear, but I think there is an analogy there to the way that the ancient Gnostics were. And texts like the Gospel of Thomas, you see, could easily be a kind of gateway text, as it were, you know, that they present a Jesus who isn't that different from the Jesus of the New Testament, but who, once you have, you know, got used to the idea of that Jesus, you know, you might be ready then for the Jesus of, say, the Gospel of Philip or of the Apocryphon of John or something like that. So there may be an analogy there. But it's always a difficult one because, you know, these texts don't come, you know, with a manual. They don't come with, you know, with something that says, hey, you know, look, you know, this is how to interpret this text and so on. So a lot of these things are just guesses, you know.
Yeah, and I remember something I've told before. It's some people have asked, why aren't these Gospels in the New Testament? I'll just go to them and say, have you read these Gospels? If you sit down and read them, you'll probably pretty quickly find out why they're not part of a text.
Well, I mean, part of it, I think, is down, when it comes to canon, it's down to popularity as well, because one of the reasons that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all survived, as it were, was because they were so popular. I mean, one of the things that we forget is that in antiquity, texts survive, by and large, if lots of people are copying them. If you've only got two people that make copies of the text, you've only got two texts, you know, and they quickly vanish. If you've got hundreds and hundreds of people across many different cities in the ancient Mediterranean copying these texts, then you have dozens and dozens of these texts. And so you get the kind of effect where, you know, what is popular becomes ever more popular and what's less popular becomes ever less popular. And I think that's one thing that's worth bearing in mind. I mean, we're talking about a battle which is a kind of popularity contest in a way. And one of the reasons that the texts that make it into the New Testament make it is because they were simply the ones that got copied more than anything else. And in fact, you know, if you read some of the non-canonical texts, some of them, and not all of them, because some of them are quite brilliant in all sorts of ways and quite stirring and amazing, but some of them are extraordinarily difficult to understand. I mean, to some extent, Gospel of Thomas is like that. It's not easy. It's not an easy read. You know, I mean, we tend to like narratives, don't we? We tend to like things where something is put together as an enjoyable narrative so we can get some idea of cause and effect and this A to B to C to D. And lots of these texts don't have that kind of structure at all, you know. So there's a very important contrast going on there.
Well, we've talked a lot about canonicity. I want to give my listeners their preview of something that's coming up. March 22nd, I'm going to have Charles Hill on the show, and he's going to be talking about two books, the early texts of the New Testament and who chose the gospel. So if you want to hear more about canonicity, be sure to listen in that day. But for now, we're going to take another break. I'm Nick Peters. My guest is Dr. Mark Goodacre, professor of New Testament and Christian origins at Duke University in North Carolina. We'll be back after this break.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at CYIWorldwide.com.
I'm Nick Peters, and this is the Deeper Waters Podcast, and my guest is Dr. Mark Goodacre this Saturday. But if you're tuning in next Saturday, my guest is going to be Don Johnson. He's an apologist of his own radio show. He's written a book recently called How to Talk to a Skeptic. He sent it to me and said, hey, tell me what you think. I said, I think you should be on my show. So he agreed, and he's going to be coming on. He's going to be talking with us about how to talk to a skeptic. But now we're going to go back to Dr. Mark Goodacre about the Gospel of Thomas. Now, let's get to your case here that the Gospel of Thomas is dependent on the synoptics. Now, first off, let's be clear. What do you mean by the synoptics?
The synoptic Gospels are Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And they are synoptic because the word synoptic just means you can look at them together. Syn is together. Optic is to see. So it means you can look at them together. And when you look at Matthew, Mark, and Luke together in what's called a synopsis of the Gospels, you can see that they follow largely the same order. Lots of material has exactly the same wording. So those three are different from the Gospel of John, where you don't have quite the same intensity of agreement amongst them. So that's the differentiation that's going on there, which is fairly standard in academic study of the New Testament to talk about the synoptics in John.
Okay, so why is it that the Gospel of Thomas then would depend on the synoptics?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, where I build my case from is to ask the most basic question of all first, the same one that I'd ask if I'd got two students with very similar pieces of work, and I would say, okay, how similar are they? Are they similar enough to suggest that one is copying from the other? And that's really where I begin my study on the Gospel of Thomas, and I say, okay, well, how similar are they? Because if you've got broadly parallel material, but the wording is massively different, then you could easily say, hey, they just knew the same traditions. They're just independent reports of the same sayings. But the thing is, the Gospel of Thomas isn't like that. The Gospel of Thomas has material that is so close at points to the text of Matthew, Mark, and Luke as to make it really, really likely, I think, that Thomas actually has a direct link with the synoptics. I then ask the subsequent question, which direction does it go in? Because, of course, theoretically, it could be that Matthew, Mark, and Luke know Thomas. It could be that way around. And so I do a subsequent thing where I show, no, in fact, Thomas is the secondary gospel to the others. Thomas actually knows the synoptic gospels because of certain features that it carries over from the synoptics. But that's the first and most important thing. You just have to make sure that the texts are similar enough to make the case. Are there enough agreements that make it likely that what we're dealing with is a direct link rather than an independent link of the kind that you would only find through links in oral tradition.
And using one of the synoptics wouldn't be a problem because many scholars think Matthew and Luke used Mark, for instance, and since Luke says he talked to many eyewitnesses, some of them were written, we can assume, sure, he used some written sources. So using the synoptics isn't the problem.
No. Okay. That's right.
But you've said there are indications, though, that it's the synoptics that are prior and Thomas comes later rather than the other way around. What are these signs that you see?
There's a whole bunch of them. I mean, one of them is that occasionally you'll get a term that is very particular to one gospel that's almost like a kind of fingerprint of that particular gospel that then turns up in the Gospel of Thomas. And I call these diagnostic shards. using an analogy from archaeology, because archaeologists, they'll often be digging up all sorts of things and little fragments of pots and all the rest of it. But then what happens is, as they're digging up all of their pots and seeing the different things, there's only certain bits that will actually help you to diagnose the date of the piece, and that piece will be a diagnostic shard, the piece that helps you to date the entire pot. And it's a bit like that with parallels between Thomas and the Synoptic Gospels. There are certain elements in the parallels which help you to diagnose that Thomas is familiar with the Synoptics. So one of the obvious examples is there's a saying of Jesus where he says, a prophet is not welcome except in his own is not without honor except in his own country, you see. Now, when Luke recreates that saying, when Luke writes that saying, he uses a particular Greek word, dektos, which is the word meaning accepted or something like that. So a prophet is not without this word accepted right there in the way that he reconstructs that saying. And then when you find the same saying in the Gospel of Thomas, it uses exactly the same word. So it's just like a little bit of a fingerprint there. Or to give another example, where you have in the tenants in the vineyard parallel, you get in Luke the vineyard owner, he says, perhaps they will respect my son. And then you look over at the Gospel of Thomas, and there it is as well, perhaps he will respect my son. You have that same little turn of phrase, exactly like the one that you have in Luke. So Thomas carries over the little literary pieces that you find in specific Gospels. So it's what we call in New Testament criticism redactional features. So where Luke redacts Mark or his other sources in a particular way, and then Thomas takes over the very way that Luke recrafts his source material. That's what provides the sort of the key indication. And I argue that in lots of places you see Luke taking over characteristics of Matthew, and Thomas taking over characteristic expressions of Matthew, and Thomas taking over characteristic expressions of Luke. I mean, maybe since I've given a couple of examples from Luke, I'll give one from Matthew. Matthew likes the term kingdom of heaven, or more literally, the kingdom of the heavens. And this comes 32 times in Matthew, never in Mark, never in Luke. Kingdom of the heavens, it's Matthew's particular way of phrasing stuff about the kingdom of God. And lo and behold, there in the Gospel of Thomas, in two parallels with Matthew, there we have kingdom of the heavens, just the same. And so what I argue is that where you get the Gospel of Thomas taking over characteristic, distinctive phrases that belong to another Gospel, the odds are that that text has borrowed from the other one. And I should say, not just me that's saying this, that there are a bunch of other people, you know, who've made the same type of case. It's just that I sort of try and argue it in a particular way over perhaps a little more length than other people have done. But if you look at Simon Gathercole's book, for example, he makes the same argument that synoptic fingerprints keep showing up in the Gospel of Thomas.
Now, you've said there are several scholars who make this case, and where any of my listeners might be concerned, where this is probably just the Christians who are making this case, that non-Christian scholars look at this with the exact same skepticism, don't they?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's one of those things where the people who are in favor of Thomas's independence of the Synoptics and Thomas's familiarity with the Synoptics, they're from across the spectrum. So, you know, they will involve people of different faith commitments and none.
Yeah, in fact, Bart Ehrman, for instance, who certainly is no friend of Orthodox Christianity, has said that if you want to know about the historical Jesus, the first place you have to start with is the four canonical Gospels that we have.
That's right, yeah. He doesn't feel that the Gospel of Thomas is a very useful source at all for historical Jesus work. That's right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I haven't fully persuaded him yet, I don't think, about Thomas's familiarity with the Synoptic Gospels, but we can always live in hope.
Now, when you talk about the Gospel of Thomas, now, could it contain some authentic information, even aside from the ones that's copied from the Synoptics, that actually does go back to the historical Jesus? Do you think that's possible?
It's certainly possible, and lots of people have argued that this is the case. I must admit, I've not actually found anything in the sayings that are unique to Thomas where I think, oh yes, I bet that's a bit of original historical Jesus material that's found its way into Thomas there. So I am a bit of a skeptic on that front. I don't think that Thomas is full of Jesus material that hadn't found its way into the canonical text. So I'm a little bit skeptical of the view that it's a good source for historical Jesus information. I think that what Thomas is really useful for is telling us about second century Christian movements, the way that the gospel tradition was developing. I think it's less helpful in the quest for getting Jesus sayings material. You know, and I say that I'm not especially pleased with that, because obviously as a historian I'd love to find more of Jesus' sayings. You know, sometimes people will say to me, oh, you know, why is it that, you know, you're so keen, you know, to try and disprove that Jesus says stuff. It's not the case at all. I would love to find more stuff. If someone presents me tomorrow Jesus' diaries written in, you know, the year 30, I'd be absolutely delighted. I think any ancient historian would be bonkers if they didn't hope to find more interesting material. I mean, we would love to know more about Jesus, and what's more, about lots of other characters in early Christianity. It's just that I don't think the Gospel of Thomas is the place to go for that material.
Yeah, I have to say, when you were talking about finding lost sayings of Jesus, I thought back immediately to one of your podcasts about how the teeth will be provided.
Yes, that's a great story. I'm not sure how many of your viewers would be, your listeners would be familiar with that, but yes, that's a lovely piece, and it's very clearly a hoax, which is where a very prominent scholar simply invented a saying of Jesus in the middle of the 20th century, where you have the disciples. Jesus, you know, this saying that you get a lot in the Gospels, there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth, and the disciples say, but what if we haven't got any teeth? And Jesus says, teeth will be provided. And this scholar, Coleman Norton, claimed to have found this actual original saying of Jesus out in Morocco while he was over there, posted over there during the war. And he wrote it up, and it was published in a major journal, in the Catholic Biblical Quarterly. And it's almost certainly a hoax. He just made it up. And one of the reasons that we know it was a hoax is that people actually heard him telling that joke several years before he'd published this alleged discovery, you know. And in fact, you can actually find versions of that joke that go right back to the late 19th century. So yeah. Yes, we all love the idea of new Jesus sayings or lost gospels or fresh fragments turning up. And that's why I think it's always the first instinct of the scholar to be skeptical of any new finding or anything like that, because otherwise, you know, we can get drawn into something that, is less than authentic.
Anyone wanting further information on that, Dr. Grudecker does have a great show on it on the ENT pod. You'll find there's a lot of humorous moments in such a folds into the ENT pod. Definitely makes it a very enjoyable podcast to listen to. And now you also know what scholars
Thanks.
Do to have some fun. They just make up a lot of hoaxes, apparently.
Right.
When you've said, though, that we probably won't find much going back to historical Jesus aside from what we know of from the Synoptics, but there is still value in studying the Gospel of Thomas for historical Jesus studies, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. Well, kind of. I mean, I'm probably I'm not sure quite how to describe the spectrum, but I'm teaching a course on the historical Jesus at the moment at Duke, and we are going to have a session next week on the Gospel of Thomas and looking at whether or not it's helpful for historical Jesus studies. But my basic view is it's not helpful. I don't think there's anything much that I can draw from the Gospel of Thomas that's going to help me with my study of the historical Jesus, to be frank. And I say that with regret, because obviously I would like to have more sources rather than fewer, but I don't think it's very useful for historical Jesus studies, no. I think that it's fairly useless for historical Jesus studies. I think it tells us more about how some people were thinking about Jesus in the second century, how they were reconfiguring things, how they were dwelling on Jesus and that sort of thing, but I don't think it's very helpful for historical Jesus studies.
But that doesn't mean, though, that it's of no value to our study. We can still learn a lot of information
right.
That will be helpful for us when we're studying the Gospel of Thomas. What information do you think we can really get out of the Gospel of Thomas that can help us with our studies?
That's a great question, and it's a tough one because, as I was saying, we don't know fully, you know, where the document comes from and all the rest of it, but. I think for one thing, it does show that you do have quite diverse groups of, and I'm not even sure whether I want to call them Christians, since the Gospel of Thomas doesn't use the word Christ at all, but you do have diverse groups of Christians in that period, and I think it helps you to see how some people were reflecting on Jesus in this period. And, I mentioned earlier on, for example, the attitude to the Old Testament, but another one that you could pick up on is the Gospel of Thomas has a very different view about the end times. So if you read the Gospels of the New Testament and Paul and Revelation, all of them are looking forward to an imminent end where there will be a world-transforming event of some kind when the Son of Man returns and the Kingdom of God is inaugurated. And that kind of eschatological viewpoint, I would say, I'm not sure if you agree with me, but I think that just permeates the New Testament. I think you have it on right throughout the Gospels, through Paul's letters, through Revelation, through other texts, 1 Peter, and so on. Now, the Gospel of Thomas is completely unlike that. It doesn't have things like the Kingdom of God is at hand. It doesn't have things talking about how the Son of Man is sitting on the right hand of the power and will come with the clouds. I mean, we just don't get that material at all. So anything that we might think of as a kind of an apocalyptic, eschatological view in the New Testament, you don't find a great deal of in the Gospel of Thomas. And that itself is fascinating. And it seems to be that the Gospel of Thomas replaces that sort of eschatological viewpoint with a very protological one. And what's meant by protology is like when we talk about proto or you know, like the first, you know, thing. What the Gospel of Thomas wants to do is take the individual back to the Garden of Eden. So what it thinks about is the ultimate goal of the individual mystic is to get back to the pre-fallen state of humanity. So that's really what it thinks. It's almost anti-eschatological. It's like instead of the end, it wants to get back to the beginning. And one of its unique things, you get the disciples, they come and ask Jesus about the end, just like they do in the Synoptic Gospels. And they say, you know, tell us, Jesus, about the end. And Jesus replies, so have you found the beginning then that you're talking about the end? So for the Gospel of Thomas, it's getting back to the beginning that's the really important thing.
Okay. Well, we are going to take a break now, and when we come back, I'm going to ask Dr. Brudecker about his position on another topic related to synoptics that is rather different, but one I think is worth listening to. But now, I'm Nick Peters with Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Dr. Mark Brudecker, and we're talking about the Gospel of Thomas in Q. We'll be back after this break.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcasts, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gift if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyi.org. grockworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And we're back, and I'd like to remind people that, yes, everything we do here is supported by donations, as our commercial just said. And so please make a donation to Blog Talk Radio, and if you want to, make a donation to us here at Deeper Waters. You can find out how at my blog site, deeperwaters.wordpress.com, and you can also go to donate to us through Tectonics, my ministry partner's work, or through even Risen Jesus, which is the ministry of Mike Lacona, my father-in-law. And you can also make us a donation through Ratio Christi Issues and Answers chapter, because, yes, I wear many hats. And like I said at the start of the show, if you go to Lena Klester, LaynaLecester, dot mypremierdesigns.com, use a password of love, you can buy some jewelry for your special someone this Valentine's Day. 25% of what you purchase, she will give to us here at Deeper Waters. So why not consider doing that route? Now we're back here with Dr. Goodacre, and we're going to talk about another topic that you've made quite an interesting stir on. And your position is definitely in the minority here, and that's the case with Q in its relation to the synoptics. So before we give a prelude of what we're talking about, what exactly is Q?
Q is a hypothetical text. It's never been discovered, and it's the alleged source of Matthew and Luke in a lot of the sayings material that they shared. So according to the dominant view, Matthew and Luke didn't just use Mark's gospel, but they also used a document which for convenience is called Q. The origins are probably from the German word for source, so Quelle. So that's the Q in Q stands for Quelle, which is the sort of enigmatic source. I sometimes think, in fact, that the use of the letter Q is one of the things that gives the document its mystique, because, of course, you know, we get a Q in James Bond, for those that like James Bond as I do. You get a Q in Star Trek The Next Generation. And so I think when people say, well, hey, there's a Q involved in early Christianity too, they think, you know, there's something going to be particularly exciting about this. But yes, it's a mainstream view. You're quite right. The consensus of scholarship now, for at least a century, probably more, is that Matthew and Luke are using this text, which has long since disappeared, which for convenience is called Q. And it's one of those things, if we did find it, it would be hugely interesting, because it would mean that, you know, we had rediscovered a gospel, a Christian source that dates right back to the first century, you know, that's all about Jesus. And, you know, wouldn't that be a great discovery?
You know, when I made the announcement about Christian Apologetics Alliance, about you being on the show and talking about Q, it wasn't too long before we had James Bond and Star Trek jokes going around there.
Right, yeah, exactly, yeah, exactly, yeah. In fact, I mean, I decided, whenever I used to talk about Q, you know, people would start, you know, going on about this. And so I thought, when I write one of my books on it, I thought I'm actually going to bring that into the discussion. So I actually begin my chapter in Q by asking whether or not this Q is going to turn out to be like the Q in James Bond, you know, helping us out of difficult problems, you know, with fine little kind of gadgets. And, you know, Q actually does behave a bit like the Q in James Bond, and that it does help gospel scholars, you know, out of difficult corners that they've got themselves into, rather like Q in James Bond helps James Bond out of difficult corners that he's found himself in.
Yep, but there's one scholar, I think it's either John Meyer or Paul Meyer, and I'm sure you know which one it is, but I think he said that he wishes all New Testament scholars would put this message on the mirror and read it every day. And said that Q is a hypothetical document whose exact contents cannot be known.
Mm-hmm. Well, but do you know what, though? I mean, I kind of like the fact that he says that, because I think it's a sobering reminder. But in another way, I think it's been quite damaging, because I think that the more mysterious you make Q, the more unseen, the more strange, the more distant it is, the less easy it is to get your hands on it. And I think the less easy it is to get your hands on it, the less easy it is to argue against its existence. And I actually think that those scholars who have attempted to say, hey, let's actually just try and describe the contents of this piece. Let's actually try and look at what the text may have contained. It makes the job of people like me who think that Q didn't exist a lot easier, actually. So I know what Meyer is trying to do with that, and I do agree with him, and I think that there's something in what he's saying there. But at the same time, I think that it can also be an excuse that can for not thinking. And I've met people when I say, let's have a little discussion about gospel origins. Let's ask, could it be that there was a Q or not? And one of the things that I sometimes find is that people will use that kind of mysteriousness of Q as an excuse to avoid thinking about the topic in any kind of detail. So actually, I've got mixed feelings about that.
One thing we should also keep in mind is that when we talk about the consensus being this, this isn't just liberal scholars and such. A lot of conservative Christian scholars do believe in the existence of Q.
Absolutely. And in fact, I argue that one of the reasons for Q's great appeal is that it's loved right across the spectrum by liberal scholars who want to use it as a kind of non-canonical source that's actually found its way somehow into the canon, almost like smuggled in like Trojan's horse, and then you've got conservative scholars, who like Q because it gives you a really early witness to the historical Jesus. So, think of somebody like Ben Witherington III or Craig Evans, or Craig Blomberg. All of these characters are big fans of Q, and you might argue that it's because Q anchors lots of the gospel material that we have in the first century. But it's not true across the board. Someone like Tom Wright, who is one of my teachers in Oxford, he is very skeptical about the existence of Q. So it's not universally the case that if you are a conservative scholar, if you're an evangelical scholar, that you'll like Q. It tends to be a little bit mixed, but yes, you're absolutely right. A lot of conservative scholars are big fans of Q, and many liberal scholars are big fans of Q too, yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to remind people that we have had Witherington and Blomberg both on the show, and Blomberg is going to be back on April 26th, and we've got Craig Evans coming up on March 1st. So,
great.
Now, when we're talking about
Craig
this...
Craig and I have actually both written articles for a book that's coming out later this year, which is called The Origins of the Gospels, Four Views. And Craig Evans has done the chapter on Q. I've done the chapter on the case against Q. And then in the book, we both react to one another's positions on it. So that's something for people to look out for later in the year.
Okay. Now, when you go about explaining why you hold the position that you hold, you usually state that when we talk about the synoptic problem, I think you say we're not even teaching the problem right. Is that true?
Right, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of people really don't understand the synoptic problem, which is a shame because it's incredibly straightforward. And also, it's one of the really fun things about New Testament study. One of the things I do with my first-year students is anybody that's taking Intro New Testament is I get them doing a bit of colouring. They all think that I'm joking when I say, I hope you're going to bring your colouring pencils with you to the next lecture. But I mean it, and what we do is we print out pieces of gospel synopsis, like we were talking about earlier on, where you put Matthew, Mark, and Luke in parallel columns, and then you colour them in accordance with their agreements and disagreements. It's enormously good fun, and it helps you to see just how similar Matthew, Mark, and Luke are at some points, and also just how different they are at some points. So it's a really interesting experiment. So yes, you have to get some idea in order to understand this whole business about Q and so on. First of all, what the synoptic problem is and how it actually works. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I can picture it. Right now, see, my wife's an artist, and I can picture her confusion. I said, "Honey, I'm going to go and study the Gospels right now. Can I borrow your crayons?"
Right. Exactly. And the thing is, a lot of people don't do that basic work, and it's a real shame because not only is it one of the most fun things to do, but it's also one of the most essential things to do. I mean, all right, not necessarily the coloring. Some people don't find that as intuitive as others, but at least digging down into the text and just looking at how similar and how different they are. I mean, I find that, I mean, if you just take something, for example, like Jesus' crucifixion, and look at the similar ways, but also the different ways that Matthew, Mark, and Luke describe that. I mean, just think, for example, of Jesus' words from the cross. You know, Matthew and Mark both have, my God, why have you forsaken me? It's one of the most prominent things in the gospel. But that doesn't appear in Luke. You know, when you look at Luke, you have things like, Father, forgive them for they don't know what they're doing, which you haven't got in Matthew and Mark. Or you have, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit in Luke, which you don't have in Matthew and Mark. So, you know, it is a fascinating study.
But the disadvantage some of us might have, if we don't know the Greek languages, we're often told, yeah, but Matthew and Luke often have the same thing in Greek verbatim, and surely this shows they were using the same source.
Right, yeah. Or either that or using one another, yes. and I mean, thereby hangs a tale. I mean, the agreements between all three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, in some of the material, and the agreements between Matthew and Luke alone in others of the material, are two of the most fascinating phenomena in synoptic study. And they do demand an explanation, because you have to say, well, why is it that they are so similar on some occasions, and some kind of copying has been taking place of some sort? And the consensus view, which I agree with, is that where Matthew, Mark, and Luke agree together, what we call the triple tradition, the stuff that's in all three, that stuff makes easily the best sense if Matthew and Luke are copying from Mark. That's the consensus view, and one which I agree with. Where I think things get kind of interesting is where you have the really similar material in Matthew and Luke that's not in Mark, because then, of course, they can't have got it from Mark because it's not there. So we have to say, where have they got it from? And that's where Q comes in. Have they got it from a third source that we can't see, that they knew, which has got lost, which we call Q? Or could it be, as I maintain, that Luke has simply taken that material directly from Matthew?
Now, could it also be, if it's not a written document, maybe it's an oral tradition that they both just have in common, and the oral tradition is remembered somehow the exact words. Is that a possibility, or do you think that one's something you'd be skeptical of too?
I'm skeptical of that. I'll tell you why. Because the kind of agreement that you see between Matthew and Luke in the material that they share is so unbelievably close that it makes easily the best sense if a literary explanation of some sort is going on there. The point is that Jesus almost certainly spoke Aramaic. He didn't speak in Greek. And what we're looking at here is sometimes 100% verbatim agreement in Greek. And it's not just Jesus' words. So John the Baptist's words in Matthew 3 and Luke 3 are almost verbatim identical at points. So there's been some kind of copying going on there. And that will even include strange Greek literary expressions, you know, that are taken over from one source in the other. And I think it would be fair to say that if there is not a literary explanation for that material in Matthew and Luke that is so similar, then we could just allow many plagiarists to walk free in the, you know, in the present day. You know, I mean, if a student said, "Hey, this is just oral tradition. I just got that from, you know, from the tradition somewhere," you know, we would say, "No, this is too close." Now, I'm aware, of course, that it's a different culture in the first century, and that, you know, orality is much more pervasive than it is today. But what we've got to bear in mind is that each of these authors, each of the gospel writers, are themselves, by definition, you know, literary people. These are people who are writing literary texts. And yes, they certainly have access to lots of oral tradition. I don't doubt that for a moment. I mean, Luke even talks about, you mentioned it yourself earlier on, you know, in Luke's preface, he talks about the tradition that he's picked up. So I think that's fair, but I mean, that doesn't negate the fact that you have lots and lots of this very, very close agreement in between Matthew and Luke, and also between Matthew, Mark, and Luke.
Yeah, so you're saying they could have used the same oral tradition, but if it was just that, then we wouldn't find them using the exact same words. Is that it?
That's right, yeah. I mean, and in fact, you know, you can see parallels where you haven't got direct literary links and see how very different, you know, they end up looking. I mean, we're talking about strings of verbatim agreement that go on for many, many words sometimes, you know. Hello.
I'm sorry. So I didn't realize I had a thing here. When you talk about the strange Greek literary expressions that have been copied, what do you have in mind with that?
Well, it's that sometimes you'll get sort of odd words or words that are unique to the particular Gospels, you know, cropping up in parallel with one another. So, I mean, to take an example from a Matthew and Luke agreement against Mark, there's a moment where Jesus is a very traumatic incident where Jesus is being mocked and beaten and spat upon, and in Matthew and Luke you have the line, "Who is the one who hit you? Who smote you? Who hit you?" And the word that's used there for hitting, in Greek, paio, only occurs there in Matthew and only occurs there in Luke. And that's what's rather striking, is that it's not just that you have verbatim agreement that goes across entire sentences, but quite often you'll have rare words just in the middle of a particular saying, rare words to that particular gospel. And you will also get it in sort of like narrative introductions to material as well, where the narrator is saying something. So, for example, Matthew regularly ends his big discourses by saying, "When Jesus had finished saying these things in the hearing of the crowds," and that happens at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, he speaks that way. And Luke, in parallel, has very much the same type of expression at the beginning of Luke chapter 7, where he talks about when Jesus had finished all these sayings in the hearing of the people. So, It's little parallels like that aren't just Jesus' words, but are also in the way that the narrator is constructing the narrative.
I couldn't help but think when you were speaking that you were pretty much telling us that you have a striking example of what you're talking about when the Gospels talk about the striking of Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right, yes, I suppose. I hadn't realized that I'd inadvertently used that, the word metaphorically and literally at the same time, yeah.
Well, it makes it really easy to remember. And then there are the cases, though, that Matthew and Luke have a story in common, but there's probably some differences in wording and such. I'm thinking of two right off the sermon, which for Luke is usually the Sermon on the Plain, and for Jesus, it's for Matthew, it's the Sermon on the Mount. And then the healing of a centurion servant, both of which show up in Matthew and Luke, but are pretty different in each one.
Right.
So, what does your theory say about those? That those would be examples, for instance, of what we'd get from oral tradition, that these people, that Matthew and Luke each get a story, may just each tell it in their own way.
Yes, I mean, lots of the time, I mean, one of the things I think is important, you know, when you're doing criticism of the Gospels, and any kind of academic study of the New Testament, you know, is to realize that each gospel is individual, and they're telling their stories in their own particular way. There's no doubt about that, you know. And, you know, I mean, one of the big differences between Matthew and Luke, say, is that Matthew rather likes having lengthy discourses. So Sermon on the Mount, which we've mentioned already, is a very famous case of that. I mean, it goes on for well over 100 verses of text with no breakup. I mean, and it doesn't even stop to say Jesus said or Jesus continued, and you know, it's just like one great big long sermon that lasts three chapters of text. And Luke's not quite like that. Luke likes to break up any of long discourses with a little bit of narrative, with a little miracle story, even you know, with a little line or so, just to introduce, you know, some a disciple or someone coming up and saying something. So, you know, each gospel writer has their own very particular way of doing things, definitely.
Well, I've got a little something I can add to that later on, I think, but we're going to take a quick break, our final break. We'll be back. We're going to be wrapping things up with Dr. Mark Goodacre, Professor of New Testament and Christian Origins at Duke University in North Carolina. I am Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back after this break.
Oh, yeah. Hey, folks, it's Will ZPI, and you guys got to check out CYIWorldwide.com. Home of the Grok Show, free MP3s, music, advice, and even prayer support. That again is CYIWorldwide.com. Check it out.
And we're back. My guest is Dr. Mark Goodacre, and we're talking about the Synoptic Gospels, the Gospel of Thomas and Q. And you were talking about the writers each writing their own individuality. The analogy I usually like to use here for explaining that, and you can tell me what you think of this, is that if I have Jehovah's Witnesses come by, it for me, it's Christmas has come early this year, and I get to enjoy a good back and forth with them. And then when they left, well, I'll call people and tell them about it. And I'll call my folks, and my folks are good Christian people. They're not theologically inclined. They don't do the apologetics work like I do. And so I'll give them the basic Reader's Digest, Cliff Notes version of what happened. It's true as far as I can remember, but it's not the whole deal. And then if I call my in-laws or some friends of mine who are much more into the apologetic arena, then I can go to here are a whole lot more of those inner little details and such. Mm. And both of the stories are the same, but based on the audience, I'm presenting the story a little bit differently.
Yes, yes. That's right, yes.
Yeah. Now, when you've been making this case, why is it, do you think, that so many people are skeptical about your case against Q?
Well, I think one of the things is that most people are brought up with Q in university, in college, in Bible school, you know, so it's become so much part of the way that people do their biblical studies that they're naturally somewhat loath, you know, to leave it behind. And I know that many people who are taught it in seminary or at university are taught it without any exposure to the alternative. And I know this because I've talked to professors at universities that go, oh, you know, we just do the Synoptic Women half an hour at the beginning of the semester. A lot of people are very bored by it, you see, so they don't get people looking into the actual texts themselves and into the scholarship. And I also know this because loads and loads of the introductory textbooks are unfair in the way that they present the case. They'll present things that are problematic, but sometimes are in error, you know, and they're not deliberately trying to be deceitful or anything. They just haven't familiarized themselves with the case against the dominant hypothesis. So that's one of the reasons that it retains its popularity, because that's what's taught, and people naturally take on what their teachers teach them. And I think I've noticed that a lot of students, when you first introduce them to Q, are highly skeptical of it off the, you know, straight off the bat, because they are not quickly going to buy into a document that no one has ever seen that we know of, that is never referred to in antiquity, unless there's pretty strong evidence for it. So I know from talking to other professors at other places, you know, that they say it's a real uphill battle getting their students to accept, you know, this hypothesis. But, you know, if they're told that, you know, this is what all reasonable people think, you know, they don't want to be regarded as amongst the unreasonable minorities. So people, you know, simply don't spend the time that they might do looking at the alternatives to the case. You know, that might be a bit unfair of me to say, that might be a little bit prejudiced, but I don't think so. It's based on actual discussions with people, because I think the case against the existence of Q is quite strong. And of course, there are some people who actually do study the evidence and that come to accept the two-source theory on the basis of proper sound study of the text and the secular literature, and of course those people exist, and there are lots of them as well, and they're the people I really enjoy talking about the material with because they understand it and know it. I mean, I generally find that I get on much better with really knowledgeable people who accept the Q theory than with people who are ignorant about the data who don't accept it, you know, because quite often those who are ignorant about the study but who are skeptical about Q, you know, are just doing it because there's something they don't like about it, you know. So anyway, so that's a very long-winded answer, but I think that one of the reasons is just status quo. You know, it's been taught for many decades in, you know, all the sort of top universities and Bible colleges and seminaries and things. So, you know, it takes a long time to shift that kind of thing.
Well, how about you? Were you taught this? And if you were, what got your skepticism going so much that you were even willing to write a book against the idea of Q?
I never believed it. So I suppose that does... That for me, that's either an advantage as I'd see it, or I suppose a massive disadvantage as others would see it. But when I went out to Oxford in the 1980s, there were very few people that believed in Q. It was generally regarded by my teachers as being a problematic hypothesis. So, for example, E.P. Sanders, who was one of my teachers, he was the Dean Island Professor of the Exegesis of Holy Scriptures, a very sort of august name that the top bod in New Testament was given. He was very skeptical about the existence of Q. I mean, he thought that it was very clear that there was a direct link between Matthew and Luke of some sort. And that, I suppose, gave me the courage to keep going with my own skepticism. So I never believed in it at all. And since none of my teachers did either, there was no invitation to, I suppose. And so I did get interested in the problem very early on. I did spend a lot of time studying it. And I quite wanted to write a book about the non-existence of Q for my doctoral thesis. But my advisor very usefully said to me that it's best to do the potboiler for your second book or your third book. And for your first book, just do something that proves to the examiners that you can actually, you know, do the topic and, you know, make your doctoral thesis a little bit more boring and workaday, and then do something more exciting for general publication afterwards. So that was the route I took. So when I wrote my book, The Case Against Q, in 2002, that was something which I'd wanted to do for many years, and finally got the chance to do. But insofar as I had a degree of success, at least, in persuading people at least to look again at the hypothesis, part of it was that I was very fortunate in one respect, which is that my own interest in this topic coincided with the birth in and popularity of the internet. So I had a website online in the mid to late 90s that already was skeptical about Q, at a time when there really wasn't a lot on the internet at all about academic biblical studies. And I think in a funny way that has actually helped get a bit more profile, especially back in those days. It gained a bit more profile for the anti-Q case than would have been possible in earlier years.
Yeah, as one with my master's thesis and doctorate ahead of me, I'm back here thinking, be boring. Should I take notes on this point or not?
You know, right.
Remembering that, I've been told that your doctoral dissertation will probably be pretty boring and no one will ever read it.
Absolutely, yeah. And in fact, I mean, I remember the very first draft chapter that I gave to my advisor. He said it was too lively. And so, you know, and I said to him, I said, well, you know, I didn't want it to be too boring. And he said, you know, doctoral theses are boring, Mark, you know. And so the next one, I deliberately went out of my way. I thought, right, I'll show how boring I can be. And I wrote the most boring thing imaginable. And I gave it to him, and he said, yes, that's perfect. So, yes, yeah. It's one of those disappointing things in the life of the graduate student, I think.
Going back to Q, I'm also thinking about how it's affected our culture so much, including the skeptical community. I remember reading Burton Mack's book, I think it's Who Wrote who wrote the Gospels. I don't remember
the
entire.
Who
wrote the New Testament?
Yeah,
yes.
Who wrote the New Testament?
And he has all these Q communities lined up,
mm-hmm.
and so on. Okay, so we've got hypothetical communities that are based on a hypothetical document. Isn't this going a bit too far?
Mm-hmm. And I think with Burton Mack's work as well, there's a real anomaly there, which is he thinks that Luke's Gospel is written in about 120, and he thinks that Matthew's Gospel was written in 80. So Matthew's Gospel is written 40 years earlier than Luke's Gospel, and yet is completely unknown to Luke. I mean, this is ludicrous. I mean, we can see people like Ignatius appear to know Matthew's Gospel in the early 2nd century. It seems utterly bonkers that Luke doesn't know Matthew's Gospel when it's a document that looks very similar to it, you know, with birth narratives, you know, with resurrection appearances and with a sermon at the beginning, you know what I mean? So, yeah, I don't know. I used Burton Mack as one of those people I bounced off quite a bit in my research, because I generally found that I disagreed with almost everything he said.
Yes, and when we talk about all these communities after that existed, and we definitely don't have any record of these communities at all, as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's no indication that there were any groups that just followed Jesus originally just because, hey, we just really like the teaching and who cares about all this narrative stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I suppose what people like Mack would have said, and what people like Kirster and Robinson would say before him, is that if you look at the early chapters of 1 Corinthians, that Paul is there talking about groups of people that esteem wisdom or Sophia. And, you know, so they try and make the case that those sorts of Christians might have been the kind of people that were behind Q and an early Thomas. But there are so many other ways that one can read, you know, that stuff. It's a tough one, because I suppose insofar as I'd want to, you know, try and be fair and open, one of the things that I would say is that I think we always have to remember when we're doing ancient history that so many of the pieces are missing, so much of the stuff we just don't know. You know, so, you know, there are texts that have disappeared, there are communities that have disappeared, and there are certainly lots of oral traditions that have disappeared by their nature because they're never written down. So, you know, there is a lot of material that's lost to us. But I suppose for me the question is, what's the best way of responding to that situation? Is it to be creating documents, communities, trajectories, and so on willy-nilly? Or is it better, in a slightly more sober way, to say, well, what does the evidence actually point to, you know? So, you know, I suppose I'm one of those, I'm slightly more of a spoil sport type scholar. A lot of the time I want to say, okay, that's a great idea, now show me the evidence for it.
Yeah, that's always been my position also, to go for the evidence entirely. It's a question
yeah.
every Christian needs to be asking. Your position is definitely still in the minority. Do you see it gaining any ground right now or in the near future? Do you see any other scholars coming your way on this one?
Yes, I mean, Francis Watson has just written a book called Gospel Writing, in which he embraces the anti-Q position. So that was a great blessing. He's a scholar at the University of Durham in the UK. So I was very encouraged by that, I must say. Also, there's a blog called The Jesus Blog, run by Chris Keith and Anthony Ladon. And they actually run a little a poll this week called Do You Q? And I was very pleasantly surprised to see, I mean, I've just called it up. I mean, so far there are 429 votes, and so far the Q supporters are 189, that's 44%, and the Q deniers are at 240, which is 55%. So, now, of course, that's just a blog. It's just a very small segment of the academic community, and you might say that people that read blogs, maybe they're more likely, you know, to be a bit avant-garde and a bit against, you know, some of the sort of standard views. But having said all of that, it's quite nice to see in, you know, something that's admittedly a sketch like that, to see the Q deniers coming out on top of the cue affirmers, and quite surprising to me, really, and very gratifying, I must say. So yes, I think that some ground has been made. But I always say as well that it's very important as a scholar to be humble and to say lots of the time, I could be wrong. And it's a bit like your thing about, John P. Meyer, and the mantra, standing in front of the mirror in the morning. But I think a more important mantra is all of us, just to say, I could be wrong. And I say that lots, I could be wrong. And there's been certain positions where I've argued things and I've tried things out on my blog and this sort of thing. And then I've thought, because people seem unpersuaded by them, I think, okay, well, I could be wrong about that. I'm not going to go ahead to publication with that, And I think, I think that's very important, that especially in the arts and humanities, a bit of humility is important, because we're all in the end servants of the data to some degree or other, just as we're also standing on the shoulders of giants that have gone before us, So lots of the time, so much of what we say is likely to be wrong. So I think it's good to keep reminding ourselves I could be wrong. Having said that, I think I'm right about Q.
Okay, well, we've got less than 5 minutes left in the show, so this is a chance for us to start wrapping things up. Now, if Maya, listeners want to know more about you, I've given them a little bit. Can you remind them where they need to go to find out more about you?
The easiest thing to do is just to go to Mark Goodacre, that's my name, at markgoodacre, all one word, .org, markgoodacre.org. Or even easier, just Google the name Mark Goodacre and you'll get me. Or to find the podcast, my podcast is called NT Pod. And if you just Google for NT Pod or go to iTunes and look for NT Pod, you should find me there.
Yeah, and the podcast, like I said, it's good if you get a quick drive across town, you got 10 or 15 minutes, you want to educate yourself on the way, listen to that one. This one is good for if you have a couple of hours waiting at the airport. As we're getting ready to go, I suppose we could see if, in your words, if you have one more thing you'd like to say to our audience. What's the final message you would like to leave with my audience?
I don't know, really. I mean, I think the most important thing with any of this is just to enjoy your study and to become passionate about it, because, one of the things I always say to my students is that the more passionate you are about your study, the more you'll enjoy it, the more that you'll remember the material that you're studying. Sometimes people talk about a study as if it's something where you have to really kind of set your nose to the grindstone and, you just got to sit down and pore over your notes. But actually, if you get genuinely interested in the stuff and just read and read and read and ponder and think about it, you don't have to sort of learn anything by rote, because it sticks, because it's so interesting. So I think, just follow your passions, because so much of the study of early Christianity is genuinely fascinating, really fascinating.
Well, Dr. Goodacre, I've certainly enjoyed having you on, and I certainly agree with you about passion. It's crime point that we realize how passionate we need to be about this, but it's been a joy having you on here talking about these issues, and I hope we'll see you back on here again sometime.
It's been a great pleasure. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you. And we're going to be signing off here soon. I'd like to remind everyone that next week we're going to have Don Johnson on. He's got his own radio show, and he's going to be coming on this one, and we're going to be talking about his book, How to Talk to a Skeptic. Personally, I recommend doing so in whatever language they speak, but I think he gives you a little bit more than that. So for now, I'm Nick Peters, signing off for the Deeper Waters podcast, and we'll see you next week.